I accept your thanks on behalf of everybody at Apple. Chapter 29. Apple Stores. Genius Bars and Sienna Sandstone. The Customer Experience. Jobs hated to cede control of anything, especially when it might affect the customer experience. But he faced a problem. There was one part of the process he didn't control, the experience of buying an Apple product in a store. The days of the bite shop were over. Industry sales were shifting from local computer specialty shops to mega chains and big box stores, where most clerks had neither the knowledge nor the incentive to explain the distinctive nature of Apple products. All that the salesman cared about was a $50 spiff, Jobs said. Other computers were pretty generic, but Apple's had innovative features and a higher price tag. He didn't want an iMac to sit on a shelf between a Dell and a Compaq while a uniformed clerk recited the specs of each. Unless we could find ways to get our message to customers at the store, we were screwed. In great secrecy, Jobs began in late 1999 to interview executives who might be able to develop a string of Apple retail stores. One of the candidates had a passion for design and the boyish enthusiasm of a natural-born retailer, Ron Johnson, the vice president for merchandising at Target, who was responsible for launching distinctive-looking products, such as a tea kettle designed by Michael Graves. Steve is very easy to talk to, said Johnson in recalling their first meeting. All of a sudden, there's a torn pair of jeans and turtleneck, and he's off and running about why he needed great stores. If Apple is going to succeed, he told me, we're going to win on innovation, and you can't win on innovation unless you have a way to communicate to customers. When Johnson came back in January 2000 to be interviewed again, Jobs suggested that they take a walk. They went to the sprawling 140-store Stanford Shopping Mall at 8:30 a.m. The stores weren't open yet, so they walked up and down the entire mall repeatedly and discussed how it was organized, what role the big department stores played relative to the other stores, and why certain specialty shops were successful. They were still walking and talking when the stores opened at 10, and they went into Eddie Bauer. It had an entrance off the mall and another off the parking lot. Jobs decided that Apple stores should have only one entrance, which would make it easier to control the experience. And the Eddie Bauer store, they agreed, was too long and narrow. It was important that customers intuitively grasp the layout of a store as soon as they entered. There were no tech stores in the mall, and Johnson explained why. The conventional wisdom was that a consumer, when making a major and infrequent purchase such as a computer, would be willing to drive to a less convenient location where the rent would be cheaper. Jobs disagreed. Apple stores should be in malls and on main streets, in areas with a lot of foot traffic, no matter how expensive. We may not be able to get them to drive 10 miles to check out our products, but we can get them to walk 10 feet, he said. The Windows users, in particular, had to be ambushed. If they're passing by, they will drop in out of curiosity. If we make it inviting enough, and once we get a chance to show them what we have, we will win. Johnson said that the size of a store signaled the importance of the brand. Is Apple as big of a brand as the Gap? He asked. Jobs said it was much bigger. Johnson replied that its stores should therefore be bigger. Otherwise, you won't be relevant. Jobs described Mike Markola's maxim that a good company must impute. It must convey its values and importance in everything it does, from packaging to marketing. Johnson loved it. It definitely applied to a company's stores. The store will become the most powerful physical expression of the brand, he predicted. He said that when he was young, He had gone to the wood-paneled, art-filled, mansion-like store that Ralph Lauren had created at 72nd and Madison in Manhattan. "Whenever I buy a polo shirt, I think of that mansion, which was a physical expression of Ralph's ideals," Johnson said. Mickey Drexler did that with the Gap. You couldn't think of a Gap product without thinking of the great Gap store with the clean space and wood floors and white walls and folded merchandise. When they finished, they drove to Apple and sat in a conference room playing with the company's products. There weren't many, not enough to fill the shelves of a conventional store, but that was an advantage. The type of store they would build, they decided, would benefit from having few products. It would be minimalist and airy and offer a lot of places for people to try out things. "Most people don't know Apple products," Johnson said. "They think of Apple as a cult. You want to move from a cult to something cool, and having an awesome store where people can try things will help that." The stores would impute the ethos of Apple products: playful, easy, creative, and on the bright side of the line between hip and intimidating. The prototype. When Jobs finally presented the idea, the board was not thrilled. Gateway Computers was going down in flames after opening suburban stores, and Jobs' argument that his would do better because they would be in more expensive locations was not, on its face, reassuring. "Think different" and "here's to the crazy ones" made for good advertising slogans, but the board was hesitant to make them guidelines for corporate strategy. "I'm scratching my head and thinking, this is crazy," recalled Art Levinson, the CEO of Genentech, who joined the Apple board in 2000. "We are a small company, a marginal player. I said that I'm not sure I can support something like this." Ed Woolard was also dubious. "Gateway has tried this and failed, while Dell is selling direct to customers without stores and succeeding," he argued. Jobs was not appreciative of too much pushback from the board. The last time that happened, he had replaced most of the members. This time, for personal reasons as well as being tired of playing tug-of-war with Jobs, Woolard decided to step down. But before he did, the board approved a trial run of 4 Apple stores. Jobs did have one supporter on the board. In 1999, he had recruited the Bronx-born retailing prince Millard "Mickey" Drexler, who, as CEO of Gap, had transformed a sleepy chain into an icon of American casual culture. He was one of the few people in the world who were as successful and savvy as Jobs on matters of design, image, and consumer yearnings. In addition, he had insisted on end-to-end control. Gap stores sold only Gap products, and Gap products were sold almost exclusively in Gap stores. "I left the department store business because I couldn't stand not controlling my own product, from how it's manufactured to how it's sold," Drexler said. "Steve is just that way, which is why I think he recruited me." Drexler gave Jobs a piece of advice: secretly build a prototype of the store near the Apple campus, furnish it completely, and then hang out there until you feel comfortable with it. So Johnson and Jobs rented a vacant warehouse in Cupertino. Every Tuesday for 6 months, they convened an all-morning brainstorming session there, refining their retailing philosophy as they walked the space. It was the store equivalent of Ives Design Studio, a haven where Jobs, with his visual approach, could come up with innovations by touching and seeing the options as they evolved. "I loved to wander over there on my own, just checking it out," Jobs recalled. Sometimes he made Drexler, Larry Ellison, and other trusted friends come look. On too many weekends, when he wasn't making me watch new scenes from Toy Story, "He made me go to the warehouse and look at the mock-ups for the store," Ellison said. He was obsessed by every detail of the aesthetic and the service experience. It got to the point where I said, "Steve, I'm not coming to see you if you're going to make me go to the store again." Allison's company, Oracle, was developing software for the handheld checkout system, which avoided having a cash register counter. On each visit, Jobs prodded Ellison to figure out ways to streamline the process by eliminating some unnecessary step, such as handing over the credit card or printing a receipt. If you look at the stores and the products, you will see Steve's obsession with beauty as simplicity, this Bauhaus aesthetic and wonderful minimalism, which goes all the way to the checkout process in the stores, said Ellison. It means the absolute minimum number of steps. Steve gave us the exact, explicit recipe for how he wanted the checkout to work. When Drexler came to see the prototype, he had some criticisms. "I thought the space was too chopped up and not clean enough. There were too many distracting architectural features and colors." He emphasized that a customer should be able to walk into a retail space and with one sweep of the eye, understand the flow. Jobs agreed that simplicity and lack of distractions were keys to a great store, as they were to a product. "After that, he nailed it," said Drexler. The vision he had was complete control of the entire experience of his product, from how it was designed and made to how it was sold. In October 2000, near what he thought was the end of the process, Johnson woke up in the middle of a night before one of the Tuesday meetings with a painful thought. They had gotten something fundamentally wrong. They were organizing the store around each of Apple's main product lines, with areas for the Power Mac, iMac, iBook, and PowerBook. But Jobs had begun developing a new concept: the computer as a hub for all your digital activity. In other words, your computer might handle video and pictures from your cameras, and perhaps someday your music player and songs, or your books and magazines. Johnson's pre-dawn brainstorm was that the stores should organize displays not just around the company's four lines of computers, but also around things people might want to do. For example, I thought there should be a movie bay where we'd have various Macs and PowerBooks running iMovie and showing how you can import from your video camera and edit. Johnson arrived at Jobs's office early that Tuesday and told him about his sudden insight that they needed to reconfigure the stores. He had heard tales of his boss's intemperate tongue, but he had not yet felt its lash. Until now. Jobs erupted. "Do you know what a big change this is?" he yelled. "I've worked my ass off on this store for 6 months, and now you want to change everything." Jobs suddenly got quiet. "I'm tired. I don't know if I can design another store from scratch." Johnson was speechless, and Jobs made sure he remained so. On the ride to the prototype store, where people had gathered for the Tuesday meeting, he told Johnson not to say a word, either to him or to the other members of the team. So the 7-minute drive proceeded in silence. When they arrived, Jobs had finished processing the information. "I knew Ron was right," he recalled. So to Johnson's surprise, Jobs opened the meeting by saying, "Ron thinks we've got it all wrong. He thinks it should be organized not around products, but instead around what people do." There was a pause, then Jobs continued. "And you know, he's right." He said they would redo the layout, even though it would likely delay the planned January rollout by 3 or 4 months. "We've only got one chance to get it right." Jobs liked to tell the story, and he did so to his team that day, about how everything that he had done correctly had required a moment when he hit the rewind button. In each case, he had to rework something that he discovered was not perfect. He talked about doing it on Toy Story when the character of Woody had evolved into being a jerk, and on a couple of occasions with the original Macintosh. If something isn't right, you can't just ignore it and say you'll fix it later, he said. That's what other companies do. When the revised prototype was finally completed in January 2001, Jobs allowed the board to see it for the first time. He explained the theories behind the design by sketching on a whiteboard, then he loaded board members into a van for the 2-mile trip. When they saw what Jobs and Johnson had built, they unanimously approved going ahead. It would, the board agreed, take the relationship between retailing and brand image to a new level. It would also ensure that consumers did not see Apple computers as merely a commodity product like Dell or Compaq. Most outside experts disagreed. "Maybe it's time Steve Jobs stopped thinking quite so differently," Business Week wrote in a story headlined, "Sorry, Steve, here's why Apple stores won't work." Apple's former chief financial officer, Joseph Graziano, was quoted as saying, "Apple's problem is it still believes the way to grow is serving caviar in a world that seems pretty content with cheese and crackers." And the retail consultant, David Goldstein, declared, "I give them 2 years before they're turning out the lights on a very painful and expensive mistake." Wood, stone, steel, glass. On May 19, 2001, the first Apple store opened in Tysons Corner, Virginia, with gleaming white counters, bleached wood floors, and a huge Think Different poster of John and Yoko in bed. The skeptics were wrong. Gateway stores had been averaging 250 visitors a week. By 2004, Apple stores were averaging 5,400 per week. That year, the stores had $1.2 billion in revenue, setting a record in the retail industry for reaching the billion-dollar milestone. Sales in each store were tabulated every 4 minutes by Ellison software, giving instant information on how to integrate manufacturing, supply, and sales channels. As the stores flourished, Jobs stayed involved in every aspect. Lee Clow recalled, "In one of our marketing meetings just as the stores were opening, Steve made us spend a half hour deciding what hue of gray the restroom signs should be." The architectural firm of Bolin Sawinski Jackson designed the signature stores, but Jobs made all of the major decisions. Jobs particularly focused on the staircases, which echoed the one he had built at Next. When he visited a store as it was being constructed, he invariably suggested changes to the staircase. His name is listed as the lead inventor on 2 patent applications on the staircases, one for the see-through look that features all glass treads and glass supports melded together with titanium, the other for the engineering system that uses a monolithic unit of glass containing multiple glass sheets laminated together for supporting loads. In 1985, as he was being ousted from his first tour at Apple, he had visited Italy and been impressed by the gray stone of Florence's sidewalks. In 2002, when he came to the conclusion that the light wood floors in the stores were beginning to look somewhat pedestrian, a concern that it's hard to imagine bedeviling someone like Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, Jobs wanted to use that stone instead. Some of his colleagues pushed to replicate the color and texture using concrete, which would have been 10 times cheaper, but Jobs insisted that it had to be authentic. The gray-blue Pietra Serena sandstone, which has a fine-grained texture, comes from a family-owned quarry, Il Cassone, in Firenzuola outside of Florence. "We select only 3% of what comes out of the mountain because it has to have the right shading and veining and purity," said Johnson. Steve felt very strongly that we had to get the color right, and it had to be a material with high integrity. So designers in Florence picked out just the right quarried stone, oversaw cutting it into the proper tiles, and made sure each tile was marked with a sticker to ensure that it was laid out next to its companion tiles. Knowing that it's the same stone that Florence uses for its sidewalks assures you that it can stand the test of time, said Johnson. Another notable feature of the stores was the Genius Bar. Johnson came up with the idea on a 2-day retreat with his team. He had asked them all to describe the best service they'd ever enjoyed. Almost everyone mentioned some nice experience at a Four Seasons or Ritz-Carlton hotel. So Johnson sent his first 5 store managers through the Ritz-Carlton training program and came up with the idea of replicating something between a concierge desk and a bar. What if we staffed the bar with the smartest Mac people, he said to Jobs. We could call it the Genius Bar. Jobs called the idea crazy. He even objected to the name. You can't call them geniuses, he said. They're geeks. They don't have the people skills to deliver on something called the Genius Bar. Johnson thought he had lost, but the next day he ran into Apple's general counsel, who said, By the way, Steve just told me to trademark the name Genius Bar. Many of Jobs' passions came together for Manhattan's Fifth Avenue store, which opened in 2006. A cube, a signature staircase, glass, and making a maximum statement through minimalism. It was really Steve's store, said Johnson. Opened 24/7, it vindicated the strategy of finding signature high-traffic locations by attracting 50,000 visitors a week during its first year. Remember, Gateway's draw 250 visitors a week. This store grosses more per square foot than any store in the world, Jobs proudly noted in 2010. It also grosses more in total, absolute dollars, not just per square foot, than any store in New York. That includes Saks and Bloomingdale's. Jobs was able to drum up excitement for store openings with the same flair he used for product releases. People began to travel to store openings and spend the night outside so they could be among the first in. My then 14-year-old son suggested my first overnighter at Palo Alto, and the experience turned into an interesting social event, wrote Gary Allen, who started a website that caters to Apple Store fans. He and I have done several overnighters, including 5 in other countries, and have met so many great people. In July 2011, a decade after the first ones opened, there were 326 Apple stores. The biggest was in London's Covent Garden, the tallest in Tokyo's Ginza. The average annual revenue per store was $34 million. And the total net sales in fiscal 2010 were $9.8 billion. But the stores did even more. They directly accounted for only 15% of Apple's revenue, but by creating buzz and brand awareness, they indirectly helped boost everything the company did. Even as he was fighting the effects of cancer in 2011, Jobs spent time envisioning future store projects, such as the one he wanted to build in New York City's Grand Central Terminal. One afternoon, he showed me a picture of the Fifth Avenue store and pointed to the 18 pieces of glass on each side. This was state-of-the-art in glass technology at the time, he said. We had to build our own autoclaves to make the glass. Then he pulled out a drawing in which the 18 panes were replaced by 4 huge panes. That is what he wanted to do next, he said. Once again, it was a challenge at the intersection of aesthetics and technology. If we wanted to do it with our current technology, we would have to make the cube a foot shorter, he said. And I didn't want to do that, so we have to build some new autoclaves in China. Ron Johnson was not thrilled by the idea. He thought the 18 panes actually looked better than 4 panes would. The proportions we have today work magically with the colonnade of the GM building, he said. It glitters like a jewel box. I think if we get the glass too transparent, it will almost go away to a fault. He debated the point with Jobs, but to no avail. When technology enables something new, he wants to take advantage of that, said Johnson. Plus, for Steve, less is always more. Simpler is always better. Therefore, if you can build a glass box with fewer elements, it's better, it's simpler, and it's at the forefront of technology. That's where Steve likes to be, in both his products and his stores. Chapter 30. The Digital Hub. From iTunes to the iPod. Connecting the Dots. Once a year, Jobs took his most valuable employees on a retreat, which he called the Top 100. They were picked based on a simple guideline: the people you would bring if you could take only 100 people with you on a lifeboat to your next company. At the end of each retreat, Jobs would stand in front of a whiteboard. He loved whiteboards because they gave him complete control of a situation and they engendered focus, and ask, "What are the 10 things we should be doing next?" People would fight to get their suggestions on the list. Jobs would write them down and then cross off the ones he decreed dumb. After much jockeying, the group would come up with a list of 10. Then Jobs would slash the bottom 7 and announce, "We can only do 3. By 2001, Apple had revived its personal computer offerings. It was now time to think different. A set of new possibilities topped the "What Next" list on his whiteboard that year. At the time, a pall had descended on the digital realm. The dot-com bubble had burst, and the NASDAQ had fallen more than 50% from its peak. Only 3 tech companies had ads during the January 2001 Super Bowl, compared to 17 the year before. But the sense of deflation went deeper. For the 25 years since Jobs and Wozniak had founded Apple, the personal computer had been the centerpiece of the digital revolution. Now experts were predicting that its central role was ending. It had matured into something boring, wrote the Wall Street Journal's Walt Mossberg. Jeff Whiteson, the CEO of Gateway, proclaimed, "We're clearly migrating away from the PC as the centerpiece." It was at that moment that Jobs launched a new grand strategy that would transform Apple, and with it the entire technology industry. The personal computer, instead of edging toward the sidelines, would become a digital hub that coordinated a variety of devices, from music players to video recorders to cameras. You'd link and sync all these devices with your computer, and it would manage your music, pictures, video, text, and all aspects of what Jobs dubbed your digital lifestyle. Apple would no longer be just a computer company, indeed it would drop that word from its name, but the Macintosh would be reinvigorated by becoming the hub for an astounding array of new gadgets, including the iPod and iPhone and iPad. When he was turning 30, Jobs had used a metaphor about record albums. He was musing about why folks over 30 develop rigid thought patterns and tend to be less innovative. People get stuck in those patterns, just like grooves in a record, and they never get out of them, he said. Of course, there are some people who are innately curious, forever little kids in their awe of life, but they're rare. At age 45, Jobs was now about to get out of his groove. FireWire. Jobs' vision that your computer could become your digital hub went back to a technology called FireWire, which Apple developed in the early 1990s. It was a high-speed serial port that moved digital files, such as video, from one device to another. Japanese camcorder makers adopted it, and Jobs decided to include it on the updated versions of the iMac that came out in October 1999. He began to see that FireWire could be part of a system that moved video from cameras onto a computer, where it could be edited and distributed. To make this work, the iMac needed to have great video editing software, so Jobs went to his old friends at Adobe, the digital graphics company, and asked them to make a new Mac version of Adobe Premiere, which was popular on Windows computers. Adobe's executive stunned Jobs by flatly turning him down. The Macintosh, they said, had too few users to make it worthwhile. Jobs was furious and felt betrayed. "I put Adobe on the map, and they screwed me," he later claimed. Adobe made matters even worse when it also didn't write its other popular programs, such as Photoshop, for the Mac OS X, even though the Macintosh was popular among designers and other creative people who use those applications. Jobs never forgave Adobe, and a decade later, he got into a public war with the company by not permitting Adobe Flash to run on the iPad. He took away a valuable lesson that reinforced his desire for end-to-end control of all key elements of a system. My primary insight when we were screwed by Adobe in 1999 was that we shouldn't get into any business where we didn't control both the hardware and the software, otherwise we'd get our head handed to us. So starting in 1999, Apple began to produce application software for the Mac, with a focus on people at the intersection of art and technology. These included Final Cut Pro, for editing digital video, iMovie, which was a simpler consumer version, iDVD, for burning video or music onto a disc, iPhoto, to compete with Adobe Photoshop, GarageBand, for creating and mixing music, iTunes, for managing your songs, and the iTunes Store, for buying songs. The idea of the digital hub quickly came into focus. "I first understood this with the camcorder," Jobs said. "Using iMovie makes your camcorder 10 times more valuable. Instead of having hundreds of hours of raw footage you would never really sit through, you could edit it on your computer, make elegant dissolves, add music, and roll credits, listing yourself as executive producer. It allowed people to be creative, to express themselves, to make something emotional. That's when it hit me that the personal computer was going to morph into something else." Jobs had another insight. If the computer served as the hub, it would allow the portable devices to become simpler. A lot of the functions that the devices tried to do, such as editing the video or pictures, they did poorly because they had small screens and could not easily accommodate menus filled with lots of functions. Computers could handle that more easily. And one more thing. What Jobs also saw was that this worked best when everything, the device, computer, software, applications, FireWire, was all tightly integrated. "I became even more of a believer in providing end-to-end solutions," he recalled. The beauty of this realization was that there was only one company that was well-positioned to provide such an integrated approach. Microsoft wrote software. Dell and Compaq made hardware. Sony produced a lot of digital devices. Adobe developed a lot of applications. But only Apple did all of these things. "We're the only company that owns the whole widget, the hardware, the software, and the operating system," he explained to Time. "We can take full responsibility for the user experience. We can do things that the other guys can't do." Apple's first integrated foray into the digital hub strategy was video. With FireWire, you could get your video onto your Mac, and with iMovie, you could edit it into a masterpiece. Then what? You'd want to burn some DVDs so you and your friends could watch it on a TV. So we spent a lot of time working with the drive manufacturers to get a consumer drive that could burn a DVD, he said. We were the first to ever ship that. As usual, Jobs focused on making the product as simple as possible for the user, and this was the key to its success. Mike Evangelist, who worked at Apple on software design, recalled demonstrating to Jobs an early version of the interface. After looking at a bunch of screenshots, Jobs jumped up, grabbed a marker, and drew a simple rectangle on a whiteboard. "Here's the new application," he said. "It's got one window. You drag your video into that window, then you click the button that says burn. That's it. That's what we're going to make." Evangelist was dumbfounded, but it led to the simplicity of what became iDVD. Jobs even helped design the burn button icon. Jobs knew digital photography was also about to explode, so Apple developed ways to make the computer the hub of your photos. But for the first year at least, he took his eye off one really big opportunity. HP and a few others were producing a drive that burned music CDs, but Jobs decreed that Apple should focus on video rather than music. In addition, his angry insistence that the iMac get rid of its tray disk drive and use instead a more elegant slot drive meant that it could not include the first CD burners, which were initially made for the tray format. "We kind of missed the boat on that," he recalled, "so we needed to catch up real fast." The mark of an innovative company is not only that it comes up with new ideas first, but also that it knows how to leapfrog when it finds itself behind. iTunes. It didn't take Jobs long to realize that music was going to be huge. By 2000, people were ripping music onto their computers from CDs or downloading it from file-sharing services such as Napster and burning playlists onto their own blank discs. That year, the number of blank CDs sold in the United States was 320 million. There were only about 281 million people in the country. That meant some people were really into burning CDs, and Apple wasn't catering to them. "I felt like a dope," he told Fortune. "I thought we had missed it. We had to work hard to catch up." Jobs added a CD burner to the iMac, but that wasn't enough. His goal was to make it simple to transfer music from a CD, manage it on your computer, and then burn playlists. Other companies were already making music management applications, but they were clunky and complex. One of Jobs's talents was spotting markets that were filled with second-rate products. He looked at the music apps that were available, including Real Jukebox, Windows Media Player, and one that HP was including with its CD burner, and came to a conclusion. They were so complicated that only a genius could figure out half of their features. That is when Bill Kincaid came in. A former Apple software engineer, he was driving to a track in Willows, California to race his Formula Ford sports car while, a bit incongruously, listening to National Public Radio. He heard a report about a portable music player called the Rio that played a digital song format called MP3. He perked up when the reporter said something like, "Don't get excited, Mac users, because it won't work with Macs." Kincaid said to himself, "Ha! I can fix that." To help him write a Rio manager for the Mac, he called his friends Jeff Robin and Dave Heller, also former Apple software engineers. The product they produced, known as SoundJam, offered Mac users an interface for the Rio and software for managing the songs on their computer. In July 2000, when Jobs was pushing his team to come up with music management software, Apple swooped in and bought SoundJam, bringing its founders back into the Apple fold. All three stayed with the company, and Robin continued to run the music software development team for the next decade. Jobs considered Robin so valuable he once allowed a Time reporter to meet him only after extracting the promise that the reporter would not print his last name. Jobs personally worked with them to transform SoundJam into an Apple product. It was laden with all sorts of features, and consequently a lot of complex screens. Jobs pushed them to make it simpler and more fun. Instead of an interface that made you specify whether you were searching for an artist, song, or album, Jobs insisted on a simple box where you could type in anything you wanted. From iMovie, the team adopted the sleek, brushed metal look and also a name. They dubbed it iTunes. Jobs unveiled iTunes at the January 2001 Macworld as part of the Digital Hub strategy. It would be free to all Mac users, he announced. Join the music revolution with iTunes and make your music devices 10 times more valuable, he concluded to great applause. As his advertising slogan would later put it, rip, mix, burn. That afternoon, Jobs happened to be meeting with John Markoff of the New York Times. The interview was going badly, but at the end, Jobs sat down at his Mac and showed off iTunes. It reminds me of my youth, he said as the psychedelic patterns danced on the screen. That led him to reminisce about dropping acid. Taking LSD was one of the 2 or 3 most important things he'd done in his life, Jobs told Markoff. People who had never taken acid would never fully understand him. The iPod. The next step for the Digital Hub strategy was to make a portable music player. Jobs realized that Apple had the opportunity to design such a device in tandem with the iTunes software, allowing it to be simpler. Complex tasks could be handled on the computer, easy ones on the device. Thus was born the iPod, the device that would begin the transformation of Apple from being a computer maker into being the world's most valuable company. Jobs had a special passion for the project because he loved music. The music players that were already on the market, he told his colleagues, truly sucked. Phil Schiller, John Rubinstein, and the rest of the team agreed. As they were building iTunes, they spent time with the Rio and other players while merrily trashing them. We would sit around and say, these things really stink, Schiller recalled. They held about 16 songs, and you couldn't figure out how to use them. Jobs began pushing for a portable music player in the fall of 2000, but Rubinstein responded that the necessary components were not available yet. He asked Jobs to wait. After a few months, Rubinstein was able to score a suitable small LCD screen and rechargeable lithium polymer battery. The tougher challenge was finding a disk drive that was small enough but had ample memory to make a great music player. Then, in February 2001, he took one of his regular trips to Japan to visit Apple's suppliers. At the end of a routine meeting with Toshiba, the engineers mentioned a new product they had in the lab that would be ready by that June. It was a tiny 1.8-inch drive, the size of a silver dollar, that would hold 5 gigabytes of storage, about 1,000 songs, and they were not sure what to do with it. When the Toshiba engineers showed it to Rubinstein, he knew immediately what it could be used for. 1,000 songs in his pocket. Perfect. But he kept a poker face. Jobs was also in Japan, giving the keynote speech at the Tokyo Macworld Conference. They met that night at the Hotel Okura, where Jobs was staying. I know how to do it now, Rubinstein told him. All I need is a $10 million check. Jobs immediately authorized it. So Rubinstein started negotiating with Toshiba to have exclusive rights to every one of the discs it could make, and he began to look around for someone who could lead the development team. Tony Fadell was a brash entrepreneurial programmer with a cyberpunk look and an engaging smile who had started 3 companies while still at the University of Michigan. He had gone to work at the handheld device maker General Magic, where he met Apple refugees Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson, and then spent some awkward time at Philips Electronics, where he bucked the staid culture with his short bleached hair and rebellious style. He had come up with some ideas for creating a better digital music player, which he had shopped around unsuccessfully to Real Networks, Sony, and Philips. One day he was in Colorado, skiing with an uncle, and his cell phone rang while he was riding on the chairlift. It was Rubenstein, who told him that Apple was looking for someone who could work on a small electronic device. Fidel, not lacking in confidence, boasted that he was a wizard at making such devices. Rubenstein invited him to Cupertino. Fidel assumed that he was being hired to work on a personal digital assistant, some successor to the Newton. But when he met with Rubenstein, the topic quickly turned to iTunes, which had been out for 3 months. "We've been trying to hook up the existing MP3 players to iTunes, and they've been horrible, absolutely horrible," Rubenstein told him. "We think we should make our own version." Fidel was thrilled. "I was passionate about music. I was trying to do some of that at Real Networks, and I was pitching an MP3 player to Palm." He agreed to come aboard, at least as a consultant. After a few weeks, Rubenstein insisted that if he was to lead the team, he had to become a full-time Apple employee. But Fidel resisted. He liked his freedom. Rubenstein was furious at what he considered Fidel's whining. "This is one of those life decisions," he told Fidel. "You'll never regret it." He decided to force Fidel's hand. He gathered a roomful of the 20 or so people who had been assigned to the project. When Fidel walked in, Rubenstein told him, "Tony, we're not doing this project unless you sign on full-time. Are you in or out? You have to decide right now." Fidel looked Rubenstein in the eye, then turned to the audience and said, "Does this always happen at Apple, that people are put under duress to sign an offer?" He paused for a moment, said, "Yes," and grudgingly shook Rubenstein's hand. It left some very unsettling feeling between John and me for many years, Fidel recalled. Rubenstein agreed. I don't think he ever forgave me for that. Fidel and Rubenstein were fated to clash because they both thought that they had fathered the iPod. As Rubenstein saw it, he had been given the mission by Jobs months earlier, found the Toshiba disk drive, and figured out the screen, battery, and other key elements. He had then brought in Fidel to put it together. He and others who resented Fidel's visibility began to refer to him as Tony Baloney. But from Fidel's perspective, before he came to Apple, he had already come up with plans for a great MP3 player, and he had been shopping it around to other companies before he had agreed to come to Apple. The issue of who deserved the most credit for the iPod, or who should get the title Podfather, would be fought over the years in interviews, articles, web pages, and even Wikipedia entries. But for the next few months, they were too busy to bicker. Jobs wanted the iPod out by Christmas, and this meant having it ready to unveil in October. They looked around for other companies that were designing MP3 players that could serve as the foundation for Apple's work, and settled on a small company named Portal Player. Fidel told the team there, "This is the project that's going to remold Apple, and 10 years from now, it's going to be a music business, not a computer business." He convinced them to sign an exclusive deal, and his group began to modify Portal Player's deficiencies, such as its complex interfaces, short battery life, an inability to make a playlist longer than 10 songs. That's it! There are certain meetings that are memorable both because they mark a historic moment and because they illuminate the way a leader operates. Such was the case with the gathering in Apple's fourth floor conference room in April 2001, where Jobs decided on the fundamentals of the iPod. There to hear Fidel present his proposals to Jobs were Rubenstein, Schiller, Ive, Jeff Robin, and marketing director Stan Ng. Fidel didn't know Jobs, and he was understandably intimidated. When he walked into the conference room, I sat up and thought, "Whoa, there's Steve." I was really on guard because I'd heard how brutal he could be. The meeting started with a presentation of the potential market and what other companies were doing. Jobs, as usual, had no patience. "He won't pay attention to a slide deck for more than a minute," Fidel said. When a slide showed other possible players in the market, he waved it away. "Don't worry about Sony," he said. "We know what we're doing, and they don't." After that, they quit showing slides, and instead Jobs peppered the group with questions. Fidel took away a lesson. "Steve prefers to be in the moment, talking things through. He once told me, if you need slides, it shows you don't know what you're talking about." Instead, Jobs liked to be shown physical objects that he could feel, inspect, and fondle. So Fidel brought three different models to the conference room. Rubenstein had coached him on how to reveal them sequentially so that his preferred choice would be the pièce de résistance. They hid the mock-up of that option under a wooden bowl at the center of the table. Fidel began his show-and-tell by taking the various parts they were using out of a box and spreading them on the table. There were the 1.8-inch drive, LCD screen, boards, and batteries, all labeled with their cost and weight. As he displayed them, they discussed how the prices or sizes might come down over the next year or so. Some of the pieces could be put together like Lego blocks to show the options. Then Fidel began unveiling his models, which were made of styrofoam with fishing leads inserted to give them the proper weight. The first had a slot for a removable memory card for music. Jobs dismissed it as complicated. The second had a dynamic RAM memory, which was cheap but would lose all of the songs if the battery ran out. Jobs was not pleased. Next, Fidel put a few of the pieces together to show what a device with a 1.8-inch hard drive would be like. Jobs seemed intrigued. The show climaxed with Fidel lifting the bowl and revealing a fully assembled model of that alternative. "I was hoping to be able to play more with the Lego parts, but Steve settled right on the hard drive option just the way we had modeled it," Fidel recalled. He was rather stunned by the process. "I was used to being at Philips, where decisions like this would take meeting after meeting with a lot of PowerPoint presentations and going back for more study." Next, it was Phil Schiller's turn. "Can I bring out my idea now?" he asked. He left the room and returned with a handful of iPod models, all of which had the same device on the front, the soon-to-be-famous track wheel. "I had been thinking of how you go through a playlist," he recalled. "You can't press a button hundreds of times. Wouldn't it be great if you could have a wheel? By turning the wheel with your thumb, you could scroll through songs. The longer you kept turning, the faster the scrolling got, so you could zip through hundreds easily." Jobs shouted, "That's it!" He got Fidel and the engineers working on it. Once the project was launched, Jobs immersed himself in it daily. His main demand was simplify. He would go over each screen of the user interface and apply a rigid test. If he wanted a song or a function, he should be able to get there in 3 clicks, and the click should be intuitive. If he couldn't figure out how to navigate to something, or if it took more than 3 clicks, he would be brutal. There would be times when we'd rack our brains on a user interface problem and think we'd considered every option, and he would go, "Did you think of this?" said Fidel. And then we'd all go, "Holy shit!" He'd redefine the problem or approach, and our little problem would go away. Every night Jobs would be on the phone with ideas. Fidel and the others would call each other up, discuss Jobs' latest suggestion, and conspire on how to nudge him to where they wanted him to go, which worked about half the time. We would have this swirling thing of Steve's latest idea, and we would all try to stay ahead of it, said Fidel. Every day there was something like that, whether it was a switch here, or a button color, or a pricing strategy issue. With his style, you needed to work with your peers, watch each other's back. One key insight Jobs had was that as many functions as possible should be performed using iTunes on your computer rather than on the iPod. As he later recalled, in order to make the iPod really easy to use, and this took a lot of arguing on my part, we needed to limit what the device itself would do. Instead, we put that functionality in iTunes on the computer. For example, we made it so you couldn't make playlists using the device. You made playlists on iTunes, and then you synced with the device. That was controversial. But what made the Rio and other devices so brain-dead was that they were complicated. They had to do things like make playlists because they weren't integrated with the jukebox software on your computer. So by owning the iTunes software and the iPod device, that allowed us to make the computer and the device work together, and it allowed us to put the complexity in the right place. The most zen of all simplicities was Jobs's decree, which astonished his colleagues, that the iPod would not have an on-off switch. It became true of most Apple devices. There was no need for one. Apple's devices would go dormant if they were not being used, and they would wake up when you touched any key. But there was no need for a switch that would go, click, you're off, goodbye. Suddenly everything had fallen into place. A drive that would hold 1,000 songs. An interface and scroll wheel that would let you navigate 1,000 songs. A FireWire connection that could sync 1,000 songs in under 10 minutes. And a battery that would last through 1,000 songs. We suddenly were looking at one another and saying, "This is going to be so cool," Jobs recalled. We knew how cool it was because we knew how badly we each wanted one personally. And the concept became so beautifully simple, 1,000 songs in your pocket. One of the copywriters suggested they call it a pod. Jobs was the one who, borrowing from the iMac and iTunes names, modified that to iPod. The Whiteness of the Whale. Johnny Ive had been playing with the foam model of the iPod and trying to conceive what the finished product should look like when an idea occurred to him on a morning drive from his San Francisco home to Cupertino. "Its face should be pure white," he told his colleague in the car, "and it should connect seamlessly to a polished stainless steel back." "Most small consumer products have this disposable feel to them," said Ive. "There is no cultural gravity to them. The thing I'm proudest of about the iPod is that there is something about it that makes it feel significant, not disposable." The white would be not just white, but pure white. "Not only the device, but the headphones and the wires and even the power block," he recalled, "pure white." Others kept arguing that the headphones, of course, should be black like all headphones. But Steve got it immediately and embraced white, said Ive. There would be a purity to it. The sinuous flow of the white earbud wires helped make the iPod an icon. As Ive described it, there was something very significant and non-disposable about it. Yet there was also something very quiet and very restrained. It wasn't wagging its tail in your face. It was restrained, but it was also crazy with those flowing headphones. That's why I like white. White isn't just a neutral color. It is so pure and quiet, bold and conspicuous, and yet so inconspicuous as well. Lee Clow's advertising team at TBWA Chiat Day wanted to celebrate the iconic nature of the iPod and its whiteness rather than create more traditional product introduction ads that showed off the device's features. James Vincent, a lanky young Brit who had played in a band and worked as a DJ, had recently joined the agency, and he was a natural to help focus Apple's advertising on hip, millennial generation music lovers rather than rebel baby boomers. With the help of the art director, Susan Einsagen, they created a series of billboards and posters for the iPod, and they spread the options on